May it please the court.
Mr. Hunt.
Mr. Kelly, Ms. Adelman. Ida Myrick began working with Aramark in July of 1995. And from that period of time through July of 2001, she had an excellent work record. She got good evaluations, she got promotions, she got salary increases, and was never disciplined. Aramark employees are allowed not only maternity leave under FMLA, they're allowed maternity leave under their own policies. And before Jeff Yor became her supervisor, she actually availed herself of maternity leaves that were allowed. She had no problem with that. And she was allowed up to 1 year of non-FMLA leave for either child care, personal reasons, or educational pursuits. And it may have even been extended under Aramark's policy for another year. In December of 2000 and January 2001, Myrick was pregnant and experienced many complications. She had fibroid tumor, and she had gestational diabetes. So, and also in April of 2001, she went into premature labor, and she was ordered off work by her doctor, Dr. Portis. She notified her supervisor, Jeff Yor, this, although there was some denial that he was notified. Subsequently, that argument was abandoned. And she was to be allowed under FMLA at least 12 weeks off. However, she delivered on June 2nd of 2001, and the FMLA leave was not granted until July 10th of 2001.
Well, that's one of the problems here, because in terms of the way this actually unfolded, there seems to have been some glitch in the place where people put their signatures on forms, and you know, the FMLA leave was supposed to terminate at the end of, in other words, it sort of was granted, and it was going to terminate at the end of July, and that was where she ran into trouble. Because
well,
the handbook says she wasn't guaranteed a position after that 12-week period.
And that's true. Nobody's arguing that my client is guaranteed a position any more than anyone who applies for a position guaranteed a position.
No, I thought, maybe I misunderstood your argument, but I thought you were arguing that she indeed did have the right to return to her former position, even though she stayed out longer than the FMLA period, because these other people did, the people that the district court found were not comparable, that you've argued were comparable, et cetera, et cetera.
No, our argument was that she was entitled to return. She wasn't offered any position whatsoever.
Well, she didn't ask for any other position other than her old job.
Well, she just called to say, I'm coming back to work, and she was told, you've been terminated.
Right.
She wasn't offered any alternative position. She wasn't asked whether she wanted an alternative position. She wasn't even given that opportunity. Our point was that if the FMLA period was retroactively applied, even though it wasn't authorized till July, then she still had available non-FMLA leave that was allowed to others, and the non-FMLA leave allowed them to return to their positions.
But that's not, I mean, the thing about the other people is that their cases seem to have been handled in accordance with this employee handbook. That is to say, no guarantee of a job, but if something comes up, you know, we'll put you in it. And they had these high turnover, you know, lower ranked jobs basically than hers, so they got put in it. And I guess I'm also wondering, this is a somewhat different question, whether there's any reason to believe that the company by the 1999-2000 period, 2001 period, was simply enforcing the handbook in accordance with its terms more than it did earlier. I mean, what is your evidence in the record that there were all these various categories, and maybe instead of FMLA, she was really asking in April for maternity leave or some other category of leave?
Well, the evidence is her previous application.
No, but they may not tell us about the current time period. Do we have all of the documents in the record in addition to the employee handbook? Because you don't the employee handbook is not helpful to you, but if there are other documents that express this company's policy, that could be helpful.
No, the evidence in the record, both on the part of the defendant and us, makes it clear that she would be entitled, regardless of FMLA, to at least a year leave.
Where does that evidence come from? What is that, somebody's testimony, or is that written down?
Well, that's actually conceded in the
I'm just asking you, though, where it is. If the, because, you know, it would be helpful to be able to.
Well, we have it on page 9 of our brief. I'm sorry, page 6 of our brief. It talks about the fact that she is permitted that time period.
And is that out of the handbook?
Trying to find my place in it. It's in the third paragraph that I have it, and it refers to our 56 statement 128 and 129 and also 130, that she's entitled to an extended leave. And those are in response to the defendant's statement as to undisputed facts. So there was a leave policy that would allow her to be off for at least a year. She was not off for a year.
But then the question is, do they have to save her job? And I thought, according to the handbook, they don't.
No, they don't. We don't argue that if
or
she passed the FMLA. Our argument is this. If she got her non-FMLA leave before July, and then she had 12 weeks after July, yes, she is guaranteed her position under FMLA. If they translated that the decision in July was retroactive, then she's still entitled to return, not necessarily to her job, after July. She wanted to return in August, within a year. So she still had available to her, no matter whether you put which comes first, the FMLA or the non-FMLA, she's entitled to at least return. The only argument is if the after July period is FMLA, she's entitled to return to her position. If it's not FMLA, she's entitled to some position. She wasn't offered any position.
But if you look at this language of the handbook, it doesn't go quite as far as you're saying. It says an unprotected leave is not covered by the FMLA. This type of leave allows an employee to take a leave of absence without guarantee of position or pay. It doesn't say, but we'll find you some other position.
But the reality was non-FMLA employees who were not black, who were not pregnant, came back and got their position.
That takes us to the comparability issue, which
right.
you certainly have covered in your brief.
And the point of it all, too, is that here was a supervisor who mocked her status as a black employee. He mimicked what he thought was dialects of blacks and stereotypes that he felt towards blacks. So not only was she discriminated against from the standpoint of the pregnancy that she experienced or the FMLA, but it was also race-based as well. And at bare minimum, there are credibility issues, weighing issues to be determined that are not appropriate for summary judgment, and inferences that can be drawn from the activity where he was the one who recommended that he needed another person and replaced her with a non-minority or non-black employee.
Yeah.
I'd like to save the balance of my time for rebuttal.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Kelly. Mr. Kelly?
May it please the Court, I'm Kevin Kelly, and I represent the defendant, Aramark Services. Just to address a point Mr. Andrew made, there is a policy that Aramark has where employees can apply for and can potentially receive up to 1 year of leave, but as Judge Wood noted, that is without any guarantee that they'll be reinstated to their prior position.
Mr. Kelly, here's what bothers me. Consistently with that policy, you would think when she makes the phone call, not very many days after the FMLA period has expired, according to the interpretation that it started in April, they would not have used the word terminated. They would have said something like, your FMLA leave has expired, but you can apply for an extension and, you know, we can't promise you the job you had. I mean, there would have been a different conversation. The word terminated has a very final ring to it that seems inconsistent with the policy you just described.
Your Honor, I can tell you that certainly there may have been better ways to more elegantly handle this situation.
Why is that? I mean, it seems that's very euphemistic. It seems to me if you tell somebody you're terminated, you know, you're saying you're out there with the vast mass of the public. You aren't in any way, we don't even know you. You know, if you come in tomorrow and apply for a job, maybe we'll hire you, maybe we won't. But if there's this possibility for an extended leave without pay, with possibility of being found a position that the company has, that's a really different status.
Your Honor, when she was only informed of this status when she called in August and requested to return to work. She was not told at the time of the July 13th expiration that she was terminated.
Right, and I'm saying when she made that call, as I understand the record, but please correct me if this is wrong, when she made that call and said, I'm coming back August 20th, I thought she was told essentially, no, you aren't, because you've been terminated. Instead of making her aware of this potential for a longer leave.
Your Honor, when she did call in August, it was to say, I am coming back very soon, within a week.
I thought she said August 20th.
August 20th, correct. And in paragraph 76 and 78 of our 56-1 statement, we make clear, and it's undisputed, that she was offered the opportunity to seek other positions in the company, and she was the one who flatly refused that offer. She said, I only want my position as bookkeeper at the Parkway Center, which position had been filled after she surpassed the 12 weeks of leave that's guaranteed under the FMLA and also the company's policy. So she was given an opportunity to seek other positions, and she was the one who declined that offer.
And that's one of those paragraphs. The district judge has a footnote about paragraphs that were not contested. Is this one of the paragraphs that was not contested?
Your Honor, I'm not sure if it was a paragraph that was specifically ruled admitted by virtue of the local rule, or if it was admitted.
What paragraph did you say it was?
Paragraph 76 and 78 of our local rule.
That's 56-1 statement. That she mentioned.
So those were specifically admitted by the plaintiff.
Okay.
Even if Ms. Meyer had applied for and had received some sort of extended leave of absence that would not have impacted her ability to be reinstated to the job as the Parkway Center bookkeeper, which is the essence of this case, that is the only thing that she has ever claimed was discriminatory, and that is the only position that she ever sought. As the Eighth Circuit found in the Lange case, which we cited in our brief, a plaintiff like Myrick, who does not return to her job after the expiration of her 12 weeks of protected leave, once Myrick exhausted that leave, there's no inference of discrimination from the mere fact that Aramark, consistent with its policy, refuses to reinstate her at that point.
Now, of course, a critical part of your case is the finding that the leave really did begin in April and it really did expire in July. And I'm not 100% sure, but it seems to me your opponent may be contesting that, suggesting that there's a disputed issue of fact on when the FMLA leave actually started.
Your Honor, he's trying to make a claim that given the fact that the leave of absence form wasn't signed on the very bottom line until
July 10th.
It was
on the denied line, right, or whatever. Wasn't there?
There was a mid-level manager. There were four people who signed the document. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, there's only three signature lines on the approved column. It's undisputed that he signed that form in the column under denied, but he intended to approve the leave. That's entirely undisputed. And he did so simply because he was in a position where he had to sign the document, but there was no space available for his signature. Nonetheless, though, it's not as if Ms. Myrick was misled by this document in any way. First of all, it's undisputed that she was not terminated until the 12 weeks had expired on July 13th. Secondly, she didn't get this paper back. It's not like she saw this and somehow misconstrued the start date of her leave.
Could she have thought that the leave that she was taking when the complications arose in her pregnancy was not FMLA but was maternity or some other label?
Your Honor, she received from her direct supervisor, Jeff Yore, when she initially applied for the leave on April 23rd. Shortly thereafter, she received the FMLA Certification of Healthcare Provider form, which indicated the fact that she needed to get her doctor to certify her absence, which she did. The issue of the prior leaves that she took, those were both weeks of or leaves of 8 weeks duration, which are clearly within the FMLA's time frame, and so obviously she was reinstated to her job.
Right.
There's no evidence here that she could have been under any impression other than this was covered by the FMLA.
So just to be clear, it's your position or it's Aramark's position that there really aren't all these different categories of leave, that there's just FMLA leave, and that's what people take when they're off to have a baby or they're doing whatever other FMLA things there are?
Your Honor, I think their forms may have changed over the years,
okay.
and there may have been a form for maternity leave, but nonetheless, those leaves were still potentially covered under the FMLA. And of course, since
it's just, do they accumulate? I mean, that's the important question, because if you had, let's say, an automatic right to 12 weeks of maternity leave regardless of the FMLA, and then you had another 12 weeks of FMLA, she'd be in a very different position, right?
There's absolutely no evidence from the policies that are in the record here that they had anything other than a policy of adhering to the mandates of federal law under the Family Medical Leave Act. There's absolutely no evidence in this case that anyone has received the benefit that Myrick sought in this case, and that's guaranteed reinstatement to her prior job after her 12 weeks of leave expired. Even if she could state a prima facie case, Aramark's articulated a legitimate non-discriminatory reason for refusing to reinstate her, and that is, again, her failure to come back within 12 weeks. And it's Kate Maney, who is Aramark's Human Resources Director, not Jeff Yore, who is the one who decided to terminate her employment. And she did so clearly without regard to Ms. Myrick's race, because Maney didn't even know her race. Maney worked in another office in another town, and it's undisputed, and that's paragraph 77 of our Rule 56.1 statement, that she did not know Myrick's race. Now, the plaintiffs tried to make something out of comments made by her supervisor, Jeff Yore. But again, it's undisputed Yore had nothing to do with terminating Myrick.
But isn't it the case that this person you say actually performed the termination just relied on Yore? Whatever he would have said was what happened?
Your Honor, before she authorized Yore to make a commitment to the person, Carmen Cervantes, who was the replacement for Ms. Myrick, before she authorized him to do that, she conducted an independent evaluation of the situation. She reviewed Myrick's entitlement to reinstatement per the policy and per the FMLA, and since at that point in time she had surpassed the 12 weeks, she's the one who authorized her replacement. Now, as this court has found additionally in the Wallace versus SMC Pneumatics case, it's only when a subordinate employee feeds false information or conceals relevant information from the ultimate decision maker that the biases of that employee can be imputed to the ultimate decision maker. And here there's no evidence whatsoever that you're fed false information or
but
concealed.
That may be too narrow. I mean, we may have said that, but I don't know if that was an if and only if statement. There's the cat's paw kind of argument too, which is what Judge Kaney's talking about. Yes, there's, you know, this rubber stamp at the top, but the real decision maker is the person who sends the, quote, recommendations up the line, which are automatically approved.
Your Honor,
I think is the scenario that's at least being suggested here.
Well, Your Honor, I think those cases involve situations where the subordinate employee who's feeding information to the decision maker took some affirmative steps to denigrate the plaintiff or to put down the plaintiff.
Why isn't it enough if they are, in fact, the de facto decision maker? I believe we have cases that say that.
Well, Your Honor, I think those cases, again, involve situations where the subordinate employee took some affirmative step here.
Why?
We have a situation where Ms. Myrick is gone. I mean, she's, in essence, she's the causation of her termination. Her absence, her failure to be at work within 12 weeks, in accordance with their policy, is in essence what caused her termination.
But when you talk about this independent review, the independent review, I mean, she didn't contact Myrick or try to find anything else about, you know, her ability to return or what her expectations were or anything. It was just looking at the formula to see if she met, you know, if the time period elapsed, and then just authorizing it. So it wasn't really an independent evaluation, was it?
Well, Your Honor, she not only did that, but it's important to note that when Ms. Myrick requested to come back. She was offered alternative positions, and really what was at stake there was simply filling her prior job as bookkeeper, not in essence refusing to consider her for other jobs.
That's a different point. That didn't happen during the process when the decision was made to terminate her. That's happened afterwards, once you found out she was terminated and these alternatives were offered. Who offered those?
Those were offered by Kate Maney through her assistant, Maria Ariza.
So she offered those additional positions?
Correct, Your Honor.
Not her immediate supervisor?
Correct.
Not Myrick's immediate supervisor?
Correct, Your Honor.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Andre? Mr. Andre, you have 1 minute, but we'll give you an additional minute.
Thank you very much, Your Honor.
And maybe you could begin with this fact that she was offered these alternative positions.
Well, again, the problem, part of the confusion is my client was promoted to the position of an office manager, a business manager, and they were talking about bookkeeper. So there was some dispute as to what position she was supposed to have, and that was part of the difficulty that was going on. My client had been promoted by the supervisor prior to your, and had even received cards. So they were arguing about whether she was a bookkeeper at all. She was a bookkeeper before this promotion. So that's what part of this argument was about.
Right, but she was offered alternative positions.
She denies that.
Are you, even though, well, how do you deal with the fact that that's admitted in the record at paragraph 76 and 78?
I can't, to be honest with you, I cannot find 76 and 78. I was looking for it as he was talking about it. Even if that's admitted, though, it's after the fact that she's already been terminated that they're talking about that. She had filed complaints with the EEOC. I don't know whether that was part of the negotiation process or what.
But you're saying at the time she was terminated, there was no such discussion.
Exactly. And, in fact, on the point of whether Jeff Yore participated, on my brief on page 9, one of the reasons originally given through the EEOC was that she failed to contact her manager, which would require statements by Yore, which turned out to be false, that she had never contacted him. And in addition, the Jeff Yore reported that he wanted a replacement for her, and that was the reason she was being replaced, not independently because of Ms. Maney's examination. We feel that it's appropriate to at least have a hearing, a trial on this matter, not decision by summary judgment. And so we'd ask for a reversal of the decision by the trial court and at least allow my client to present her case to a fact finder.
Thank you, Mr. Andre. Thanks again to both counsel. The case will be taken under advisement. The fifth case for today is Money versus CB Accounts.
Morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. My name is Michael Ditchweiler, and I represent Todd Monet, and he is the appellant in this matter.